Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Augustine's teachings. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on St. Augustine of Hippo at his general audience, and we shine the spotlight closer on this key figure of the early church. Guidance from Gandhi. Today marks the 60th anniversary of the death of Mahatma Gandhi, India's revered spiritual leader and independence hero, and the Under-Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, himself an Indian, looks at how much Gandhi's message is still relevant today. Kenya on the brink. With clashes and rioting continuing in the African nation, we talk to a Catholic bishop and priest to try to find out what is fanning the violence there. At his weekly general audience today, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on the figure of St. Augustine of Hippo, the 4th century bishop and one of the Church's greatest thinkers. Chris Altieri reports.
The Holy Father said St. Augustine was a passionate believer who recognized the importance of bringing together faith and reason.
It was he who taught that we should believe in order to understand, and understand in order to believe. God makes himself known to our reason. Also, he always transcends what we can know through reason alone. As Augustine beautifully expressed it, God is more intimately present to me than my inmost being and higher than the highest element in me.
Pope Benedict said St. Augustine taught that by belonging to the Church, we are so closely united to Christ that we become Christ, the head whose members we are.
As our head, Christ, prays in us, yet he also prays for us as our priest, and we pray to him as our God. If you ask what particular message St. Augustine has for the men and women of today, it is perhaps his emphasis on our need for truth.
The Holy Father invited the faithful to consider St. Augustine's description of his own search for God's truth.
You were within me, and I sought you outside, in the beautiful things that you had made. You were with me, but I was not with you. You called me, you cried. You cried out and broke open my deafness. I tasted you, and now I hunger and thirst for you. Let us pray that we too may discover the joy of knowing God's truth.
A priest of the Diocese of New Ulm, Minnesota, in the United States, Father John Hess, heard the Holy Father's remarks and shared with us his thoughts on the need for conversion, a turning toward the truth in our lives.
I guess I look at the whole church and it's just this sense of conversion of heart, just away from our evil ways perhaps and our human ways sometimes, you know, people can say, but just to experience the love of God and to witness it as they live that out.
Among the many groups present at the audience were representatives of the Pontifical Mission Societies who were gathered in Rome this week for their annual meeting. Father Robert Bradler of the Diocese of Rochester, New York, is just one of the many participants.
And it's just great to be in this surrounding of all the faith commitments people make here, you know.
Following the catechesis, Pope Benedict greeted the faithful in many languages, including English.
I'm pleased to welcome all the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present at today's audience, including groups from England, Scotland, Hong Kong, and the United States of America. I greet especially the representatives of the Pontifical Mission Societies and the group who are preparing to be ordained deacons. Upon all of you, and upon your families and loved ones, I invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
Pope Benedict has been carrying out a series of reflections on St. Augustine during his general audiences this year. He has long had a special admiration for the writings and thoughts of this key figure of the early church. And as a young student, Joseph Ratzinger wrote his doctoral dissertation on St. Augustine. Jesuit Father Joseph Carola is also an expert on St. Augustine and is Professor of Patristics at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome. He explains why it is still possible to glean new insights into the teachings of this saint.
The Holy Father, as a young student in the early 1950s, wrote a dissertation on Augustine. Wrote it in 1951 and published it in 1954. And in his introduction, he says, "It is a risk to write on Augustine because so many great and towering minds have been studying him thoroughly for years." And the young Joseph Ratzinger asks himself, "Is there anything left to say?" Well, obviously there is, because his dissertation follows immediately. I know that when I was doing my own dissertation on Augustine through the 1990s, finishing in 2001, I often looked back to the young Joseph Ratzinger's question and said, well, is there anything left to say? Now, 50 years later, is there something new that we can say about Augustine? Because there are hundreds of articles every year published on this great doctor of the church. The truth of the matter is there is still something left to say about Augustine, because certainly the questions that we have today are new questions in many ways, and they will provoke new answers as we return to the Augustinian text itself, as we look more deeply at Augustine's thought. So while the challenge is great for the student to find something new in Augustine, as one of my own professors at the Augustinianum once said to me, he said, you know, you can't go anywhere in Augustine where somebody else hasn't already been. And that's true. But you can go there with new questions, and you really must allow the Augustinian text to speak for itself and not to impose categories of later theological periods upon the Augustinian text. In allowing the text to speak to us, there is still much more to be learned.
Interestingly, you mentioned there are new questions that arise, but there are also some old questions that are still around, aren't there?
Well, I think that's very true. For example, there are no new heresies. It's just the ancient heresies which continually rear their ugly heads century after century. Take, for example, the whole heresy of Pelagianism. That tendency to say that man is self-sufficient, I can do this on my own, I have no need of God. Or that God's grace is somehow extra or a kind of icing on the cake. But the truth of the matter is it's all about me, and it's all about using my free will to engage in doing the good. Well, that's a great temptation for every age. And we need to remind ourselves that at the beginning of every good act is God's grace. God is the one who is there in the beginning, who inspires the good, who strengthens our will to desire the good, to choose the good, and then to bring that to fruition. We do the good. There's no denying that our free will is engaged, and we truly cooperate, but it is a cooperation. And God's grace is what is fundamental. It's a very freeing reality, because really in his debate with Pelagius, what Augustine was doing was defending the unwashed masses out there.
That was Jesuit professor Joseph Carola speaking to my colleague Chris Altieri. It's exactly 60 years since the death of Mohandas Gandhi, India's independence hero, and some of his ashes were scattered today by his descendants in the sea off the Indian city of Mumbai to mark this anniversary. Known as Mahatma, which means great soul, Gandhi was the leader of the Indian nationalist movement against British rule and is widely considered the father of his nation. He was assassinated on this date by a Hindu fanatic in Delhi. During his life, Gandhi developed a doctrine of non-violent protest using mass civil disobedience, which led India to independence and inspired movements for civil rights and freedom across the world. A devout Hindu, Gandhi lived a spiritual life of prayer, fasting and meditation, and has long been revered as the moral conscience of his nation. But 60 years on from his death, how much does the figure of Gandhi live on in today's India? What influence did Christ's message of non-violence have on him? And what can Catholics learn from the example of this much revered leader? Well, to find out the answers, I spoke to Monsignor Felix Machado, the Under-Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, who comes from Mumbai, or Bombay, and who is Archbishop-elect of Nashik in India.
You My generation, you know, I'm born in 1948, and so the death of Mahatma Gandhi was something that all the Indian people lived. He was a very charismatic figure, very dynamic, extremely spiritual man, a man who had gone through conversions, and the man who spent literally his life for the country. So all this, as a child, I was brought up in this milieu, as it were. He was presented to us not as someone who died and passed away from our memory, but someone that gave hope to the country. And so that is the key word to emphasize here. He is presented to us Indians as a man who gave hope to the country. And so his memory still lives in everything that India is today.
So Indian school children learn all about his life.
Yes, you have streets named after him, institutions named after him. But I had a very special relationship with an institute that is in Bombay. It's called the Mahatma Gandhi House because that's where he spent most of his time when he was in Bombay, and he was in Bombay very often. We also have several programs, Development of India, that are named after Gandhi, educational institutes, hospitals, social institutes. And so the memory of Gandhi still lives very much. There are films produced, there are books that come out. In every manner, people try to keep Mahatma Gandhi's legacy alive.
Of course, he was perhaps best known for his, shall we say, pioneering. He was a pioneer of the resistance to tyranny through non-violent civil disobedience, and he used this tactic many times. But he also did many other things which perhaps are not so well known, like he led national campaigns for the alleviation of poverty, for the liberation of women, for brotherhood amongst different religions and ethnicities, and for an end to untouchability. In some ways, he was very forward-looking, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a great reformer. He was very progressive in his thinking, a man of great culture, a man of great vision. And the concept of ahimsa, you know, the non-violence, is a very spiritual concept in India. It's the Jain religion, and the Jains are very, very non-violent people in the sense that they give a central value to the concept of non-violence. And Mahatma Gandhi picked up this concept from this religion. So for him, non-violence is a spiritual struggle, as it were, you know. It's not a passive kind of non-violence, as the English word is presented, but it is something very positive, it's something very dynamic. It's a reform movement not with any political ends, but always with the accompaniment of spiritual forces. Mahatma Gandhi, therefore, not only had this concept of non-violence, which he applied in a concrete situation of India, but as you rightly mentioned, his struggle for women to uplift. He was such a reformer that he had to put up fights with the traditionalists of Indian religion, who sometimes would say that infants should be married, that girls should not go to school, that a woman who has lost her husband should be kind of despised. All these things were already taken up by other reformers. But Mahatma Gandhi was like a doyen of these people. You know, he was like the dean of these reformers.
And he spread his net so widely. But you talked there about his spirituality. And of course, when it came to his religious life, he lived a very spiritual and ascetic life of prayer, of fasting and meditation, almost like a monk. So what can Catholics learn from his example, in your view?
Well, I would say it is for the Catholic lay people to learn a lot from Gandhi by being rooted in their own Christian faith, rooted uncompromisingly in their Christian faith, could learn how one can practice one's religion in a very dynamic way, the way Mahatma Gandhi did for his religion, which was Hinduism. The Catholic Church is contributing in India a lot to the country, to the nation building. But there is always a complaint that the lay Catholic people are aloof from politics, for example. And they think that because we want to be religious, we can't involve ourselves in politics. And Mahatma Gandhi said, one who says that politics has nothing to do with religion and that religion has got nothing to do with politics understands neither religion nor politics. I think this is a good way of looking at things for our lay Catholic lay people who, by being rooted in their Catholic faith, as I said, must also take part in healthy politics and try to transform the country from within. Another thing the Catholic people can learn from Gandhi is his commitment, because as a consequence of his what he believed to be Hinduism. I think we are more fortunate in that sense. The gospel of Jesus Christ offers us so much inspiration and so much life to commit ourselves to the transformation of society, you know, loving your neighbor as yourself. In fact, Gandhi took all this from the gospel of Jesus Christ, especially from the Sermon on the Mount.
I wanted to ask you there. In fact, he did acknowledge, didn't he, that Christianity had an influence on him?
Oh, very much so. Very explicitly. Gandhi said, I would not be Gandhi without the gospel of Jesus Christ. He deeply loved the person of Jesus. He deeply loved the message of Jesus. And his quotations are really mind-boggling for us Catholics. You know, what he said about the tendency of revenge. People always have, we talk of justice often, thinking that justice means to take revenge, you know. But Mahatma Gandhi had understood what justice really meant according to the biblical message.
So what was the quotation?
And the quotation is, if I try to break tooth, one who has broken my tooth, and if I try to break eye of the one who has broken my eye, doing this, the world will be one day toothless people and the world will be of blind people.
Yes, war or violence is always a defeat for humanity.
Yes, exactly. I think Mahatma Gandhi explicitly acknowledged the value of the teachings of Jesus Christ.
Think are some of the most moving or heroic incidents in his life, which of course was so packed with action and heroic incidents?
You know, Mahatma Gandhi was not a leader who kind of made slogans, who proclaimed things from his palace. He was not a leader who just told people to go and do things and remained himself in hiding, as it were, or protected and safe. But he was there in the struggle with the people. Mahatma Gandhi was on the forefront. He was the first to go in and take the blows that were coming.
And he was also, if I may interrupt, I read that during the partition riots, he was single-handedly trying to stop the two religious groups.
His death is not totally unpredicted death. I mean, he knew the threats and he knew how he was going to die.
It's a sad irony, though, isn't it, that this is an apostle of peace and yet he had to die a violent death.
And who killed him? One of his own. I mean, you know. But I think the nation will one day learn the greatness of this man. There have been movements trying to blur his name and throw mud at his reputation. But I think nothing can stop. In fact, there is a revival now again in India with regard to the teaching of...
And it's also inspired non-violent movements elsewhere in the world. I mean, you can think of Martin Luther King in the US, the civil rights leader who was assassinated, of course.
Yes, and he called Jesus Christ as the greatest non-violent spiritual leader. Mahatma Gandhi was a Hindu and he professed Hinduism. But as I said, with the special study, liking, and also his encounters with spiritual men, you know, some Anglican priests, some Catholic priests. He even came to Rome.
Did he meet the Pope?
No, he was not. But I'm so delighted to hear that when Pope John Paul II landed in Delhi, one of the first things he did was to go and kneel at the tomb of the Mahatma. And the second time when Pope John Paul II visited Delhi in 1999 for the conclusion of the Asian Synod, once again he went and prayed at the tomb of Mahatma Gandhi. And in his speeches, Pope John Paul II had great admiration for Mahatma Gandhi. So I think, you know, the Catholic Church kind of looks at Mahatma Gandhi as a very honest, sincere, and a good partner in our dialogue with Hindus. You know, this is the Hinduism that Mahatma Gandhi represented is real Hinduism, according to me. And I think such are the leaders that we would like to have as dialogue partners. And I'm sure if Mahatma Gandhi was living today, Pope Benedict XVI would have definitely had very fruitful conversations with persons like this.
That was Monsignor Felix Machado of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Once one of Africa's most stable nations, Kenya continues to be racked by widespread ethnic violence following disputed elections, arising fears that the country could be sliding into endemic unrest. Violent clashes since the announcement of the presidential election's outcome in late December have claimed more than 850 lives, driven over 250,000 people from their homes, and sharply increased tensions between the country's dominant ethnic and tribal groups. The former UN Secretary-General, Kofi Annan, has launched a mediation bid between the country's political rivals in a bid to halt the deepening tribal bloodshed. And the Catholic Church, too, has been working hard at the grassroots level to try to dampen down tensions between the feuding sides. We spoke to Bishop Peter Kairo of Nakuru in the Rift Valley area of central Kenya, which has seen a high degree of violence. He says the church is focusing on reconciliation.
Some people have lost everything. Their houses have been torched. Some have been killed. Some have been injured. So also they are trying to retaliate. Unless that we, as a church, we speak more about the need for reconciliation and peace, and let us forget about retaliation. The purpose of the church now is reconciliation, so that we can ask all the people not to retaliate, but we have to forgive one another and work together in rebuilding our country, Kenya, instead of destroying. So we pray for the four Kofi Annan, that as he is trying to mediate between the two groups, that they agree to sit down together, to share together, and then also to see whether we can have peace.
That was Bishop Peter Kairo of Nakuru in Kenya. But with the violence showing no sign of ending and even deepening in some areas, are Kenyans worried that the country is now locked into a cycle of violent attacks and reprisals? A long-time resident in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Father Patrick Devine is the president of the National Council for Religious Superiors. He believes there is a real risk that Kenya could be sliding towards a situation of endemic violence unless urgent action is taken to resolve the differences between the feuding sides.
I would say yes, and that people are very concerned at the moment about the transformations that's going on in this conflict, the depth of seriousness and the issues that have to be addressed, the violence. People are becoming more and more entrenched, and everybody is hoping for a solution to be reached politically and diplomatically to these issues. But there's a great uncertainty in the air at the moment.
But in the meantime, you would say, it would be fair to say that, you know, attitudes are hardening and it's becoming the norm now, this violence.
Attitudes harden any time people are killed in different from different political parties or persuasions or ethnic groups. But where I am sitting now, there's gunfire around us, I'd say within 200 metres of where I am at the moment, and a lot of demonstrations and roads are closed. From Kisumu, some of our people up there, missionaries up there, they are actually confined to their houses. There's gunfire on the streets outside. In another mission, spoke to me about where they have people from different ethnic groups and were wondering what should they do, should they allow them out to go back. And I think, you know, travel is very dangerous at the moment.
How much an issue is competing resources for land at the root of some of this violence, particularly perhaps, say, in the Rift Valley?
Oh, well, I think everybody is in agreement that there's a socioeconomic factor that can be seen as a root cause for all this, as opposed to being a proximate or a trigger cause. And land issues are big, and they have always been here. You know, they talk in the last number of years about the 6% of economic growth in Kenya, but the 6% of economic growth for who? Like most economists, in an honest assessment of it, we'll realize that it's gone into very few hands. And the disparities between the rich and the poor, the poverty in this country, inequality. I mean, in Nairobi alone, if you take a population of 3 million people and that you have a million plus of those people living in dire poverty, there's something seriously wrong socioeconomically.
Is one of Kenya's main problems, do you feel, the lack of a national identity? People, though, too tend to feel perhaps more in regional or ethnic or tribal lines.
Well, in Africa, national identity, you can experience national identity of a Kenya in many aspects of life, and other aspects you don't, because after all, it's made up of 42 different tribes, and there's dualism going on here, dualism in politics. And what I mean by that, where there's a clash between traditional and, we say, what has come in from Western society in terms of politics and economics. And there's a clash there, I think, that is running through this whole crisis.
When it comes to the Catholic Church and the other churches, the other Christian denominations there, what are they doing and how important is their role in all this?
I'm glad you asked, because students like the churches and everybody are trying to address the issues of ending the violence and bringing about peace. And that's the prerequisite to going further with reconciliation. The whole area of justice and social justice, that has also been very prominent by the churches and by NGOs and the peace movement.
How badly are the people suffering, the people who've been displaced from their homes? Is their plight been rather overlooked? Is it getting worse? Or are their needs being met?
Oh, I have no doubt. Their plight is terrible. Their situation is terrible, to be uprooted from all you have, homes, families. Many of them have been affected with injuries or death. Some of them are in places where they're afraid to go out, at parish mission compounds and at other places set up by NGOs to try and help them. But any place behind people are displaced and their whole social and psychological life erupted, it is terrible pain and trauma for them.
Okay, turning to ongoing efforts at mediation, how hopeful are you and the other people, you know, that these will eventually bear fruit?
I mean, we all live with hope, and we're hopeful that the efforts being made by Kofi Annan and his team at the moment will bring the parties to the table of negotiation, and that there will be an element where they may be willing to compromise to find a way out of this, or find an area where they can agree on, maybe even to scapegoat something, to at least try and find a way out. And it will be, at the end of the day, I think, an issue of principle v. pragmatism, because the rigorousness that's attached to principles on both sides, if they stay in both corners, I don't think we're going to see our way out without this crisis becoming more intense and more widespread and, in fact, more violent. But we're hoping that there will be a political pragmatism attached to the whole negotiation.
So, to sum up, how do you feel about Kenya's immediate future?
I think that there's definitely need for more international intervention and pressure to be put on this situation. And we're hoping that the security can hold, can maintain at least, that all order doesn't break down, even though it is getting very close, I would say, to that in some areas.
That was Father Patrick Devine speaking from the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at any time of the day or the night by clicking on www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.